For the wind-up to the conclusion of the prepared portion of tonight's program, we're going to review the concluding section of Uncle Sam and the Swastika, again, from May 23rd, 1980. Once again, in addition to my own voice, you will hear the voice of my former co-host, Mark Ortiz.
In evaluating the forces that had led to the defeat of his group's efforts to bring about German reform, James Stuart Martin feared two things. First, he was afraid that the return to power of Hitler's industrialists would lead to a resurgence of Nazism in Germany. And more importantly, Martin noted that the same pattern of economic concentration that led to the ascendance of Hitler in Germany was already evident in the United States in 1950, and he expressed his fear that this concentration of power might lead to the rise of Nazism in this country. Martin concludes All Honorable Men by discussing the economics of fascism and his fears for both Germany and the U.S.
Dave and I are going to take turns reading you James Martin's conclusion in All Honorable Men. First, though, we'd like to remind you that we're reading a book written in 1950, and some of Martin's references to German Reconstruction date this text. However, we both feel that Martin's message about the dangers inherent in economic concentration is still as valid as ever.
Proceeding with the conclusion of All Honorable Men, James Stuart Martin writes, "After 2.5 years, I came back from Germany quite well aware that I had been wrestling with a buzzsaw. We had not been stopped in Germany by German business. We had been stopped in Germany by American business. The forces that had stopped us had operated from the United States, but had not operated in the open. We were not stopped by a law of Congress, by an executive order of the President, or even by a change of policy approved by the President or any member of his cabinet. In short, whatever it was that had stopped us was not the government, but it clearly had command of channels through which the government normally operates. The relative powerlessness of governments in the face of growing economic power is, of course, not new. Between the two world wars, the outstanding development in world economics was the division of territories and markets by private agreement among the largest corporations of Britain, Germany, and the United States, with minor participations by their counterparts in France, Italy, and Japan. National governments stood on the sidelines while bigger operators arranged the world's affairs."
We have the same difficulty today. What we need is to be able to have a government that controls economic power instead of becoming its tool. Since power is a public trust, including economic power, the first job of a government is to see that the power is used in the public interest and not against it. By chartering a private corporation, a government delegates to the corporate body some of its own power to regulate commerce. Strictly speaking, this is an abdication by the government. It is time to view the results of this abdication by constitutional governments in favor of private governments. The occupation of Germany has already provided a good laboratory in which we could study the activities of self-centered corporations and the activities of a German national government in which these corporate combines had a dominant influence.
The eco-political masters of Germany boosted Hitler and his program into the driver's seat at a time when the tide in the political fight between the Nazis and the supporters of the Weimar Republic was swinging against the Nazis. All of the men who mattered in banking and industrial circles could quickly agree on one program and throw their financial weight behind it. Their support won the election for the Nazis. We must assume that the same thing is not yet true in the United States. We do have economic power so concentrated that it would lie in the power of a group of not more than 100 men, if they could agree among themselves, to throw the same kind of combined economic weight behind a single program. They have not agreed yet. There are still enough divisions within the Republican Party and enough minor differences between Republicans and Democrats to indicate that on some fundamental economic questions there are different points of view, each one championed by a different faction inside the financial and industrial community itself. If the United States should run into serious economic difficulties, however, most of the conditions for a reenactment of the German drama would already exist on the American stage. The slight differences within the camp of the fraternity then may be the only real barrier to the kind of integration of the financial and industrial community behind a single repressive program like that which the financiers and industrialists of Germany executed through Hitler. Are we safe in assuming that it would take a grave economic crisis to precipitate the dangers inherent in economic concentration? The basic integration of the financial and industrial groups in the United States is evident when we look at the increase of concentration in the past few years.
Our job now, then, is to prepare for a future crisis before it happens. This means that in Germany we must have a double objective. The occupation of Germany must be put back on the track. But more than that, we have to reassert public goals in the United States, which will prevent the already apparent concentration of economic power in our own country from reaching the end it did in Germany. We cannot hope to deal with the concentration of economic power in Germany until we are able to deal with the concentration of economic power in the United States. This brings the German problem home with an urgency that has been missing in most post-war discussions about Germany. The need to treat Germany as an American problem was not felt in this country after World War I. Despite warnings from men whose experience with the German occupation had convinced them that we were entering a period of armed truce and not peace, business arrangements went ahead unchecked to rebuild a Germany that could not be expected to be anything but a steamroller. Now, with all that experience and warning behind us, and in spite of strong popular support for the reform of Germany, we have had to watch the same errors being repeated as if nothing else were possible. The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And more importantly, those forces could create a menace of their own here at home. Not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity. The men who might do this are not Nazis, but businessmen. Not criminals, but honorable men.
That again from Uncle Sam and the Swastika, May 23rd, 1980. By the way, that book, All Honorable Men, by James Stuart Martin, was published by Little Brown Books in Boston and copyrighted 1950. In the Uncle Sam and Il Duce program, you heard extracts from Sawdust Caesar by George Seldes. That was published in 1935. I do not know the publisher off the top of my head. I do not have it at hand or off the top of my head. And the other book with a description of the International Jew, that was Who Financed Hitler by James and Suzanne Poole, both hardcover and softcover editions, Dial Press, copyright 1978. Now, bear in mind the warning that James Stuart Martin gave in 1950 that Mark Ortiz and I echoed in 1980, because I am afraid, very much afraid, that just such a crisis is at hand. Jumping to the present, and regular listeners or newer listeners to the program, I should say, must accept my apology if much of what I'm about to say seems referential. I have been speaking about a great many things that I have seen, which indicates to me that the powers that be in this country are anticipating an economic crisis, and that the response to that will be the incarceration and or liquidation of large segments of the population that are deemed unnecessary or useless or perhaps even subversive. The way our national security establishment works is to formulate contingency plans, to set up plans to deal with possible future developments. And there was an op-ed column in the New York Times of May 23rd of 1994, ironically enough, the 14th anniversary, precisely, of the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, again, which Mark and I did on May 23rd of 1980. On May 23rd of 1994, 14 years to the day later, I saw the following column on the op-ed page of the New York Times. This is a column by Benjamin. It's particularly noteworthy, by the way, this column, because of who wrote it. The column is by Benjamin C. Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-Z, and Benjamin C. Schwartz is a foreign policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. And this article is adapted from the current issue of Salma Gundi. I've never heard of that, by the way. If somebody knows about that publication, please inform me. S-A-L-M-A-G-U-N-D-I. Never heard of it. But I've sure as hell heard of the RAND Corporation. For those of you not familiar with it, the RAND Corporation is a Santa Monica-based think tank, very, very close not only to the national security establishment, but the Air Force in particular. Suffice it to say that the RAND Corporation is hardly a bunch of fellow travelers or panty waste. That's not to say that analysts with the RAND Corporation are infallible or that they haven't made their share of mistakes. Certainly they have. But the following column absolutely scared the expletive deleted out of me when I read it, because it indicates to me that many of the fears that I have been expressing, when I note the apparent intelligence community connection to the gun control movement, when I note that guns don't produce crime, and when I note the martial law contingency plans on the book, when I note the very precarious situation of the American economy and the American debt crisis, when I note the draconian laws being passed to, quote, fight crime, unquote, when I note such things as the hantavirus, a rodent-borne virus, which has been the focal point of biological warfare research in the past, which has a very strange epidemiology, and which may, I say may very well, still be a biological warfare test slash weapon. I was so alarmed by the research that has emerged on the hantavirus, I was alarmed because in the event of an economic collapse, and in the event that the powers that be in this country and other places, deem large segments of the population to be unnecessary, well, poor people have the most contact with rodents, and it will be poor people that figure to suffer the most from a hantavirus epidemic. And I don't know whether this is some kind of a test. Perhaps it's a natural occurrence. Perhaps it's an accident. But I, in the past, in numerous archive shows or numerous broadcasts, have expressed my fears concerning the hantavirus outbreak and my suspicions concerning the history of hantavirus as a BW weapon. And many things, the reduction of civil liberties, martial law plans on the book, the apparent intelligence community connection to the gun control movement in connection with the martial law contingency plans, Colonel Dunlap's coup, the rumination of the military about a U.S. military coup in the year 2012, discussed in Radio Free America number 38. Colonel Dunlap's coup was the title of an article in the January 1993 edition of Atlantic Magazine. A Colonel Dunlap, an active duty Air Force colonel, wrote that essay, which won a prize in a Pentagon essay contest. The following article, I think, is potentially extremely important. It chilled me to the bone, and it indicates to me that at the very least, analysts within the national security establishment and within institutions connected to it are experiencing some of the same fears that I am, I've been experiencing concerning the future of the world economy in the United States in particular, that if my fears concerning an economic collapse and a resultant social crisis, whether a gradual collapse or a precipitous collapse, if my fears have seemed paranoid, this column to me indicates that at the very least, those fears are being shared by people within the national security establishment and close to it, and that at the very least, that is viewed as a possibility, if not an inevitability. And even if it's viewed as a possibility only, I will guarantee you dollars to donuts that if it's merely a possibility that preparations are being made, contingency plans are being laid now to deal with that possibility, and let me tell you, there are a lot of butts that are going to get kicked and kicked hard in the event that there's an economic collapse, because that is going to produce a social crisis, and I think the calm judgment of business necessity that James Stewart Martin referred to will become a reality. This particular column, again, by Benjamin C. Schwartz, a foreign policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, and carried on the op-ed page of the New York Times, America's paper of record, this is from May 23rd of 1994 on page A11. This is the 14 years to the day after I did the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast. The column reads as follows. By the way, it's datelined Santa Monica, California. That's where the RAND Corporation is located. While we celebrate the prosperity that has accompanied international economic interdependence, a serious threat to prosperity remains ignored. Today's global economy depends upon American power, but precisely because of this dependency, international capitalism may be approaching catastrophe just as it is reaching its fullest flower. This last sentence again, because it's a doozy. Today's global economy depends upon American power. But precisely because of this dependency, international capitalism may be approaching catastrophe just as it is reaching its fullest flower. There is an inherent contradiction between capitalism and international politics. Capitalist economies prosper most when labor, technology, and capital are fluid, so they are driven toward international integration. But international politics drive states to ensure that economic power is distributed in their favor at the expense of their rivals. This restricts production and markets, and thereby fragments the global economy. Thus, in the normal course of world politics, in which states must compete for security in a... a global economy is impossible to achieve. In fact, international capitalism has enjoyed only two golden ages, the periods following the Napoleonic Wars and the two world wars. The key to both these episodes of peace and prosperity has been the same, the ability and will of a single state to become a hegemonic power, taking over the security problems of weaker states so they need not pursue autarkic policies nor form trading blocs to improve their international positions. This suspension of power politics through hegemony has been the fundamental aim of American foreign policy since 1945. Even though the Cold War has ended, America's security leadership, for instance its domination of NATO and the alliance with Japan, is still necessary to hold in check the rivalries that would otherwise disrupt the stability that a global economy requires. Thus, the U.S. must continue, as the Pentagon's 1992 draft defense planning guidance argues, to dominate the international system by, quote, discouraging the advanced industrialized nations from challenging our leadership or even aspiring to a larger global or regional role, unquote. Assuming this awesome responsibility, the Pentagon asserts, ensures, quote, a market-oriented zone of peace and prosperity that encompasses more than two-thirds of the world's economy, unquote. Imposing a protectorate over two-thirds of the world economy means not only that the United States must dominate wealthy and technologically sophisticated friendly states, but that it must also deal with such nuisances as Saddam Hussein, Kim Il-sung, and Slobodan Milosevic, so that potential great powers need not acquire the means to deal with those problems themselves. This, in turn, dictates that America must spend more on national security than the rest of the world combined. Thus, stabilizing the international system is a wasting proposition. A hegemonic power forced to place such importance on military security must divert capital and creativity from the civilian sector, even as other states, freed from onerous spending for security, add resources to economically productive investments. As America's relative economic strength erodes, so does the comparative advantage over other powers upon which its hegemony is founded. America's declining advantage will spur the emergence of great power rivals, requiring the U.S. to spend more on defense to maintain its preponderance, which only further deteriorates its comparative advantage. Already, economic power has diffused from the U.S. to new centers of economic growth in Europe and Asia. Thus, a global economy bites the hegemon that feeds it, destroying the hegemon's relative dominance and shattering the very foundation upon which interdependence rests. Some hold that America can reap the reward of hegemony without paying for it. According to this argument, America can lead, but in partnership with other like-minded states. This is an oxymoron. Multilateral enterprises, from juries to UN police actions, require a leader. The indispensable foundation for integration among the advanced industrialized nations was and remains American hegemony. To hold that U.S. hegemony is no longer needed because the political, economic, and military cooperation among the great powers now ensures stability and peace is to put the cart before the horse. Most everyone applauds the highest stages of capitalism, today's complex web of global trade, production, and finance, as the dawn of a brave new world. But a genuinely interdependent economy is extraordinarily fragile. Today, the emergent high technology industries, for instance, are the most powerful engines of world economic growth, but they require a level of specialization and a breadth of markets that is possible only in an integrated world economy. It is difficult to see, therefore, how capitalism can survive the decline of the Pax Americana. 77 years ago, Lenin argued that international capitalism would be economically successful, but by growing in a world of competitive states, it would plant the seeds of its own destruction. Although the empire he built is in ruins and his revolution discredited, Vladimir Ilyich may have the last laugh. Well, I would stress that I don't agree with everything that this writer is saying, and I'm not an economics expert. But on the other hand, the bankrupting of America as a result of voodoo economics or Reaganomics, supply-side economics, which was supposed to permit a huge military buildup and also stimulate industry by cutting taxes on the corporations and wealthy, it didn't work, and it turned us from the world's biggest creditor nation to the world's biggest debtor nation. National debt was $900 billion when Jimmy Carter left office, $2.6 trillion, almost three times as high when Reagan left office 8 years later, and Smilin' George pushed it up over $4 trillion. And let me tell you, that is some serious debt. And regardless of what happens in the future, you have to pay interest on debt, which says to me that an awful lot of worthwhile things are going to be cannibalized to handle that debt. And I cannot see how an indebted America, as the cornerstone of the world's economy, can hold out indefinitely. And sooner or later, the chickens have to come home to roost. I don't know whether they're going to come home to roost 2 years from now or 50 years from now, or whether the collapse will be precipitous or gradual. But let me tell you, folks, 2 plus 2 does not, never has, and never will equal 17, and that was the operating premise of Reaganomics or voodoo economics or supply-side economics. And I think ultimately the chickens are going to come home to roost, and if you've ever seen a hen house, it is a pretty messy place. And again, the significance of this column I do not think could be exaggerated. When you have an analyst with a RAND Corporation asking, is capitalism doomed, and saying that some of Lenin's analysis might yet prove to be accurate, this is scary. Because at the very least, to me, it says that in the corridors of power, such a possibility is being realistically considered. And indeed, take a look at Radio Free America 37, or take a listen to Radio Free America 37, how the United States lost the Second World War, because in that massive archive show, which I consider my finest piece of work, I basically said that the United States lost World War II, that as a result of the realization of the Christian West concept, the incorporation of the Galen Organization as a Trojan horse, the perpetuation and propagation of liberation theory, which had its genesis with the Third Reich, and which ultimately had its fulfillment under the Reagan and Bush years, the United States basically achieved the goals of the ABN using the methodology, apparently, of the NTS, a white Russian fascist collaborationist group which worked with the Galen Organization in its Third Reich and CIA periods, and which sought to overthrow Soviet communism by instigating a revolution within the Red Army. And we saw just such a revolt in the August 1991 coup. More about that coup in weeks to come, because it now turns out that indeed George Bush and his administration was passing intelligence to Boris Yeltsin, and his forces then led to buttressing my analysis of that coup as an infiltrated coup as well as a precipitated coup that I predicted in Radio Free America number 36. It is my considered belief that the events that are now unfolding were envisioned a long time ago, and the United States is indeed going to find itself on the losing side of World War II. There are many, many very powerful elements in this country that have been and are pro-fascist, and I think just such a calm judgment of business necessity, as I think that type of decision will ultimately be made in the United States. And I will guarantee you that with analysts at the RAND Corporation thinking this way, a lot of other people in the corridors of power are thinking this way, and as a matter of course, they're getting ready for the worst. And as one looks at the hue and cry to get tough on crime and to reduce civil liberties, to take away guns, take a look at things like the Hanta virus making their appearance, I suspect, I cannot prove, but I suspect that these are all connected. And they basically are laying the foundation for a fascist America, for the liquidation of a great many people who will be deemed unnecessary, if not even openly subversive, in the event of an economic collapse. And just such a collapse, at the very least, is being considered a possibility in the corridors of power. And I think that the powers that be in this country are getting ready to kick butt, and kick butt big time. If international cooperation among the great powers is deemed necessary for a perpetuation of the relative economic largesse that some countries have enjoyed, I would not bet on the Germans participating in that cooperation. Returning to the Germany Alert newsletter for Tuesday, June 7th of 1994, in the briefing section we find the following. Anti-American ranting has become a key feature of German nationalist propaganda. A recent article in the popular Der Spiegel claimed that a new rage in advertising using junkies and drugs as success symbols is a U.S. campaign. In reality, as the weekly's editors no doubt know, the trend was launched and continues to be used mostly in Europe, notably in Germany and Japan. In our interviews with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants, we have heard of the rabid anti-Americanism that's present in Germany. Unfortunately, we're not hearing too much about it in the United States. Skipping down in the briefing column, we find the following entitled Food for Thought. Since Mercedes-Benz warned U.S. editors not to criticize Germany if they wanted advertising dollars, how much coverage of Germany have you read? Indeed, we're not hearing a whole lot about what's going on in Germany. And I certainly would not bet on the Germans to maintain that pattern of economic cooperation. Take a look to, or take a listen to, the addendum to Radio Free America 37 that I made in April in the article from the Washington Quarterly's Spring 1994 edition about the Bundesbank as America's second central bank. I think the ability of the Germans to politically and economically affect the United States could not be exaggerated. And indeed, with German corporations actively suppressing critical journalistic evaluation of Germany, with German media lambasting America and things American, and with Helmut Kohl basically announcing the formation of a joint German and French navy, and once again, as accurately reported by Germany Alert, indicating that Germany dominates France militarily, I would not bet on Germany cooperating with the United States. However, as I mentioned and as I discussed in Radio Free America 37, one of the ways the Germans have always conquered those they seek to conquer is by cultivating sympathetic elements within the nation that is targeted for conquest. Again, many American industrialists and financiers, as described in numerous archive shows, including the one extracted earlier in tonight's program, the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, many American industrialists and financiers were openly pro-fascist, and the Germans are actively courting American political figures again, both media figures and politicians. Once again, from the briefing section of Germany Alert for Tuesday, June 7th of 1994, we find the following about a directive that has been actualized by Klaus Kinkel, again, the German foreign minister and former head of the BND. Kinkel has ordered a stepped-up embrace of the U.S. extreme right. Among the political figures being courted by Bonn are, and listen to this murderer's row, Rush Limbaugh, Oliver North, Pat Buchanan, and Dan Quayle. Special briefings, expensive dinners, and well-paid consultant posts are among the treats to tempt the German supporters in Washington. Last week, in a series of private meetings, the foreign minister and spy chief urged German firms to find ways of, quote, rewarding, unquote, American extremist leaders who help Germany. Well, if we've looked at Oliver North and his cooperation with Mansour el-Qassar and the fascist milieu that he was involved in, Pat Buchanan and Dan Quayle calling for family values, Rush Limbaugh lying in his teeth about all kinds of things, this does not augur well for the future. And speaking as someone that's worked in radio for a long time in an anti-fascist capacity, I was just waiting to see Rush Limbaugh hook up with the Germans. That was a natural, folks. A match made not in heaven, but perhaps somewhere else in the spiritual world. And if international cooperation is what Benjamin C. Schwartz sees as necessary to perpetuate the relative success of post-World War II international capitalism, well, folks, don't bet on that happening, at least not on America's terms. No siree. The last item in tonight's prepared portion is an item that I actually neglected to include in the prepared portion of the second installment of the Seeds of Nuremberg done 3 weeks ago. I was analyzing the Dodd Committee, that is the various subcommittees of Thomas Dodd, an individual who was not only on the U.S. prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg, but who also was a former FBI agent, very close to Hoover and the FBI, part of the FBI contingent in Congress. He also was involved with the American Security Council and the aforementioned Charles Willoughby, the ASC, very closely connected with the World Anti-Communist League, part of the rollback or liberation milieu that I analyzed in Radio Free America number 37. And Thomas Dodd also was involved with the Bogdan-Stashinsky disinformation ploy, which attempted to link Lee Harvey Oswald and the murder of Stefan Bandera, the Ukrainian fascist leader and Galen operative, with the assassination of John Kennedy. It attempted to link Bogdan-Stashinsky and Lee Harvey Oswald and a, quote, KGB training school, unquote.